water from a puddle in the road, then moved on. A comparable herd of elephants would have been startled by the arrival of a car, would have trumpeted and circled to protect the baby. But these animals showed no fear. "Don't they see us?" she said. "Not exactly, no," Harding said. "Of course, in a literal sense, they do see us, but we don't really mean anything to them. We hardly ever take cars out at night, and so they have no experience of them. We are just a strange, smelly object in their environment, representing no threat, and therefore no interest. I've occasionally been out at night visiting a sick animal, and on my way back, these fellows block the road for an hour or more."
"What do you do?"
Harding grinned. "Play a recorded tyrannosaur roar. That gets them moving. Not that they care much about tyrannosaurs. These apatosaurs are so big, they don't really have any predators. They can break a tyrannosaur's neck with a swipe of their tail, and they know it. So does the tyrannosaur."
"But they do see us. I mean, if we were to get out of the car..."
Harding shrugged. "They probably wouldn't react. Dinosaurs have excellent visual acuity, but they have a basic amphibian visual system. It's attuned to movement. They don't see unmoving things well at all." The animals moved on, their skin glistening in the rain. Harding put the car in gear. "I think we can continue now," he said. Wu said, "I suspect you may find there are pressures on your park, just as there are pressures on Genentech's drugs." He and Hammond had moved to the living room, and they were now watching the storm lash the big glass windows.
"I can't see how," Hammond said.
"The scientists may wish to constrain you, even to stop you."
"Well, they can't do that," Hammond said. He shook his finger at Wu. "You know why the scientists would try to do that? It's because they want to do research, of course. That's all they ever want to do is research. Not to accomplish anything. Not to make any progress, just do research. Well, they have a surprise coming to them."
"I wasn't thinking of that," Wu said.
Hammond sighed.
"I'm sure it would be interesting for the scientists to do research, but you arrive at the point where these animals are simply too expensive to be used for research. This is wonderful technology, Henry, but it's also frightfully expensive technology. The fact is, it can only be supported as entertainment."
Hammond shrugged.
"That's just the way it is."
"But if there are attempts to close down..."
"Face the damn facts, Henry," Hammond said irritably. "This isn't America. This isn't even Costa Rica. This is my island. I own it. And nothing is going to stop me from opening Jurassic Park to all the children of the world."
He chuckled.
"Or at least to the rich ones. And I tell you, they'll love it."
In the back seat of the Jeep, Ellie Sattler stared out the window. They had been driving through rain-drenched jungle for the last 20 minutes, and had seen nothing since the apatosaurs crossed the road.
"We're near the jungle river now," Harding said as he drove. "It's off there, somewhere to our left."
Abruptly, he slammed on the brakes again. The car skidded to a stop in front of a flock of small green animals.
"Well, you're getting quite a show tonight," he said. "Those are compies."
"Procompsognathids," Ellie thought, wishing that Grant were here to see them. This was the animal they had seen in the fax, back in Montana. The little dark green procompsognathids scurried to the other side of the road, then squatted on their hind legs to look at the car, chittering briefly, before hurrying onward into the night.
"Odd," Harding said. "Wonder where they're off to. Compies don't usually move at night, you know. They climb up in a tree and wait for daylight."
"Then why are they out now?" Ellie said.
"I can't imagine. You know, compies are scavengers, like buzzards. They're attracted to a dying animal, and they have tremendously sensitive smell. They can smell a dying animal for miles."
"Then they're going to a dying animal?"
"Dying or already dead."
"Should we follow them?" Ellie said.
"I'd be curious," Harding said.
"Yes, why not? Let's go see where they're going."
He turned the car around and headed back toward the compies. Tim Murphy lay in the Land Cruiser, his cheek pressed against the car door handle. He drifted slowly back to consciousness. He wanted only to sleep. He shifted his position and felt the pain in his cheekbone where it lay against the metal door.
His whole body ached, his arms and his legs, and most of all his head. There was a terrible pounding pain in his head. All the pain made him want to go back to sleep. He pushed himself up on one elbow, opened his eyes, and retched, vomiting all over his shirt. He tasted sour bile and wiped his mouth with the back of his hand. His head throbbed. He felt dizzy and seasick, as if the world were moving, as if he were rocking back and forth on a boat. Tim groaned and rolled onto his back, turning away from the puddle of vomit. The pain in his head made him breathe in short, shallow gasps, and he still felt sick, as if everything were moving. He opened his eyes and looked around, trying to get his bearings. He was inside the Land Cruiser, but the car must have flipped over on its side because he was lying on his back against the passenger door, looking up at the steering wheel and beyond at the branches of a tree moving in the wind. The rain had nearly stopped, but water drops still fell on him through the broken front windshield. He stared curiously at the fragments of glass. He couldn't remember how the windshield had broken. He couldn't remember anything, except that they had been parked in the road, and he had been talking to Dr. Grant when the Tyrannosaur came toward them. That was the last thing he remembered. He felt sick again and closed his eyes until the nausea passed. He was aware of a rhythmic creaking sound, like the rigging of a boat. Dizzy and sick to his stomach, he really felt as if the whole car were moving beneath him. But when he opened his eyes again, he saw it was true. The Land Cruiser was moving, lying on its side, swaying back and forth. The whole car was moving. Tentatively, Tim rose to his feet. Standing on the passenger door, he peered over the dashboard, looking out through the shattered windshield. At first he saw only dense foliage moving in the wind, but here and there he could see gaps, and beyond the foliage the ground was 20 feet below him. He stared uncomprehendingly. The Land Cruiser was lying on its side in the branches of a large tree, 20 feet above the ground, swaying back and forth in the wind. "Oh, shit," he said. What was he going to do? He stood on his tiptoes and peered out, trying to see better, grabbing the steering wheel for support. The wheel spun free in his hand, and with a loud crack, the Land Cruiser shifted position, dropping a few feet in the branches of the tree. He looked down through the shattered glass of the passenger door window at the ground below. "Oh, shit, oh, shit," he kept repeating it. "Oh, shit, oh, shit." Another loud crack. The Land Cruiser jolted down another foot. He had to get out of here. He looked down at his feet. He was standing on the door handle. He crouched back down on his hands and knees to look at the handle. He couldn't see very well in the dark, but he could tell that the door was dented outward, so the handle couldn't turn. He'd never get the door open. He tried to roll the window down, but the window was stuck too. Then he thought of the back door. Maybe he could open that. He leaned over the front seat, and the Land Cruiser lurched with a shift in weight. Carefully, Tim reached back and twisted the handle on the rear door. It was stuck, too. How was he going to get out? He heard a snorting sound and looked down. A dark shape passed below him. It wasn't the Tyrannosaur. This shape was tubby, and it made a kind of snuffling as it waddled along. The tail flopped back and forth, and Tim could see the long spikes. It was the Stegosaur, apparently recovered from its illness. Tim wondered where the other people were, Gennaro and Sattler and the vet. He had last seen them near the Stegosaur. How long ago was that? He looked at his watch, but the face was cracked. He couldn't see the numbers. He took the watch off and tossed it aside. The Stegosaur snuffled and moved on. Now the only sound was the wind in the trees and the creaking of the Land Cruiser as it shifted back and forth. He had to get out of here. Tim grabbed the handle, tried to force it, but it was stuck solid. It wouldn't move at all. Then he realized what was wrong. The rear door was locked. Tim pulled up the pin and twisted the handle. The rear door swung open, downward, and came to rest against the branch a few feet below. The opening was narrow, but Tim thought he could wriggle through it. Holding his breath, he crawled slowly back into the rear seat. The Land Cruiser creaked, but held its position. Gripping the doorposts on both sides, Tim slowly lowered himself down.
through the narrow angled opening of the door. Soon he was lying flat on his stomach on the slanted door, his legs sticking out of the car. He kicked in the air, his feet touched something solid, a branch, and he rested his feet on it. As soon as he did, the branch bent down and the door swung wider, spilling him out of the Land Cruiser, and he fell, leaves scratching his face, his body bouncing from branch to branch, a jolt, searing pain, bright light in his head. He slammed to a stop, the wind knocked from him. Tim lay doubled over a large branch, his stomach burning pain. Tim heard another crack and looked up at the Land Cruiser, a big, dark shape 5 feet above him. Another crack. The car shifted. Tim forced himself to move, to climb down. He used to like to climb trees. He was a good tree climber. And this was a good tree to climb. The branches spaced close together, almost like a staircase. Crack! The car was definitely moving. Tim scrambled downward, slipping over the wet branches, feeling sticky sap on his hands, hurrying. He had not descended more than a few feet when the Land Cruiser creaked a final time and then slowly, very slowly, nosed over. Tim could see the big green grille and the front headlights swinging down at him, and then the Land Cruiser fell free, gaining momentum as it rushed toward him, slamming against the branch where Tim had just been, and it stopped. His face, just inches from the dented grill, bent inward like an evil mouth, headlamps for eyes. Oil dripped on Tim's face. He was still 12 feet above the ground. He reached down, found another branch, and moved down. Above, he saw the branch bending under the weight of the Land Cruiser, and then it cracked, and the Land Cruiser came rushing down toward him, and he knew he could never escape it. He could never get down fast enough, so Tim just let go. He fell the rest of the way. Tumbling, banging, feeling pain in every part of his body, hearing the Land Cruiser smashing down through the branches after him like a pursuing animal, and then Tim's shoulder hit the soft ground, and he rolled as hard as he could and pressed his body against the trunk of the tree as the Land Cruiser tumbled down with a loud metallic crash and a sudden hot burst of electrical sparks that stung his skin and sputtered and sizzled on the wet ground around him. Slowly, Tim got to his feet. In the darkness, he heard the snuffling and saw the stegosaur coming back, apparently attracted by the crash of the Land Cruiser. The dinosaur moved dumbly, the low head thrust forward, and the big cartilaginous plates running in two rows along the hump of the back. It behaved like an overgrown tortoise, stupid like that, and slow. Tim picked up a rock and threw it. "Get away!" The rock thunked dully off the plates. The stegosaur kept coming. "Go on! Go!" He threw another rock and hit the stegosaur in the head. The animal grunted, turned slowly away, and shuffled off in the direction it had come. Tim leaned against the crumpled Land Cruiser and looked around in the darkness. He had to get back to the others, but he didn't want to get lost. He knew he was somewhere in the park, probably not far from the main road. If he could only get his bearings. He couldn't see much in the dark, but then he remembered the goggles. He climbed through the shattered front windshield into the Land Cruiser and found the night vision goggles and the radio. The radio was broken and silent, so he left it behind, but the goggles still worked. He flicked them on, saw the reassuringly familiar phosphorescent green image. Wearing the goggles, he saw the battered fence off to his left and walked toward it. The fence was 12 feet high, but the Tyrannosaur had flattened it easily. Tim hurried across it, moved through an area of dense foliage, and came out onto the main road. Through his goggles, he saw the other Land Cruiser turned on its side. He ran toward it, took a breath, and looked inside. The car was empty. No sign of Dr. Grant and Dr. Malcolm. Where had they gone? Where had everybody gone? He felt sudden panic, standing alone in the jungle road at night with that empty car, and turned quickly in circles, seeing the bright green world in the goggles swirl. Something pale by the side of the road caught his eye. It was Lex's baseball. He wiped the mud off it. "Lex!" Tim shouted as loud as he could, not caring if the animals heard him. He listened, but there was only the wind and a plink of raindrops falling from the trees. "Lex!" He vaguely remembered that she had been in the Land Cruiser when the Tyrannosaur attacked.
Had she stayed there? Or had she gotten away? The events of the attack were confused in his mind. He wasn't exactly sure what had happened. Just to think of it made him uneasy. He stood in the road, gasping with panic. Lex! The night seemed to close in around him. Feeling sorry for himself, he sat in a cold, rainy puddle in the road and whimpered for a while. When he finally stopped, he still heard whimpering. It was faint, and it was coming from somewhere farther up the road.
How long has it been? Muldoon said, coming back into the control room. He was carrying a black metal case. Half an hour. Harding's jeep should be back here by now.
Arnold stubbed out his cigarette.
I'm sure they'll arrive any minute now. Still no sign of Nedry? Muldoon said.
Nope, not yet.
Muldoon opened the case, which contained 6 portable radios.
I'm going to distribute these to people in the building.
He handed one to Arnold. Take the charger, too. These are our emergency radios, but nobody had them plugged in, naturally. Let it charge about 20 minutes and then try and raise the cars. Henry Wu opened the door marked fertilization and entered the darkened lab. There was nobody here. Apparently, all the technicians were still at dinner. Wu went directly to the computer terminal and punched up the DNA logbooks. The logbooks had to be kept on computer. DNA was such a large molecule that each species required 10 gigabytes of optical disk space to store details of all the iterations. He was going to have to check all 15 species. That was a tremendous amount of information to search through. He still wasn't clear about why Grant thought frog DNA was important. Wu himself didn't often distinguish one kind of DNA from another. After all, most DNA in living creatures was exactly the same. DNA was an incredibly ancient substance. Human beings walking around in the streets of the modern world, bouncing their pink new babies, hardly stopped to think that the substance at the center of it all, the substance that began the dance of life, was a chemical almost as old as the Earth itself. The DNA molecule was so old that its evolution had essentially finished more than 2 billion years ago. There had been little new since that time. Just a few recent combinations of the old genes and not much of that. When you compared the DNA of man and the DNA of a lowly bacterium, you found that only about 10% of the strands were different. This innate conservatism of DNA emboldened Wu to use whatever DNA he wished. In making his dinosaurs, Wu had manipulated the DNA as a sculptor might clay or marble. He had created freely. He started the computer search program, knowing it would take 2 or 3 minutes to run. He got up and walked around the lab, checking instruments out of long-standing habit. He noted the recorder outside the freezer door, which tracked the freezer temperature. He saw there was a spike in the graph. That was odd, he thought. It meant somebody had been in the freezer. Recently, too, within the last half hour. But who would go in there at night? The computer beeped, signaling that the first of the data searches was complete. Wu went over to see what it had found, and when he saw the screen, he forgot all about the freezer and the graph spike. Leitzke DNA search algorithm. DNA. Version search criteria. RNA. All. Fragment. Len greater than 0. DNA incorporating RNA fragments. Myosaurs, versions 2.1 to 2.9. Procompsognathids, versions 3.0 to 3.7. Othnelia, versions 3.1 to 3.3. Velociraptors, version 1.0 to 3.0. Hypsilophodontids, versions 2.4 to 2.7. The result was clear. All breeding dinosaurs incorporated Rana, or frog DNA. None of the other animals did. Wu still did not understand why this had caused them to breed, but he could no longer deny that Grant was right. The dinosaurs were breeding. He hurried up to the control room. Lex. She was curled up inside a big 1-meter drainage pipe that ran under the road. She had her baseball glove in her mouth, and she was rocking back and forth, banging her head repeatedly against the back of the pipe. It was dark in there, but he could see her clearly with his goggles. She seemed unhurt, and he felt a great burst of relief.
Lex, it's me, Tim.
She didn't answer. She continued to bang her head on the pipe.
Come on out!
She shook her head no. He could see she was badly frightened.
Lex, he said, if you come out, I'll let you wear these night goggles.
She just shook her head.
Look what I have, he said,
holding up his hand. She stared uncomprehendingly. It was probably too dark for her to see.
It's your ball, Lex. I found your ball.
So what?
He tried another approach.
It must be uncomfortable in there. Cold, too. Wouldn't you like to come out?
She resumed banging her head against the pipe.
Why not?
There's aminals out there.
That threw him for a moment. She hadn't said aminals for years.
The aminals are gone, he said.
There's a big one. A Tyrannosaurus Rex.
He's gone.
Where did he go?
I don't know, but he's not around here now, Tim said,
hoping it was true. Lex didn't move. He heard her banging again. Tim sat down in the grass outside the pipe where she could see him. The ground was wet where he sat. He hugged his knees and waited. He couldn't think of anything else to do.
I'm just gonna sit here, he said, and rest.
Is Daddy out there?
No, he said, feeling strange. He's back at home, Lex.
Is Mommy?
No, Lex.
Are there any grown-ups out there?
Lex said. Not yet, but I'm sure they'll come soon. They're probably on their way right now.
Then he heard her moving inside the pipe, and she came out, shivering with cold and with dried blood on her forehead, but otherwise all right. She looked around in surprise and said,
Where's Dr. Grant?
I don't know. Well, he was here before.
He was?
When?
Before,
Lex said.
I saw him when I was in the pipe.
Where'd he go?
How am I supposed to know?
Lex said, wrinkling her nose.
She began to shout, Hello!
Hello! Dr. Grant! Dr. Grant!
Tim was uneasy at the noise she was making. It might bring back the Tyrannosaur. But a moment later he heard an answering shout. It was coming from the right, over toward the Land Cruiser that Tim had left a few minutes before. With his goggles, Tim saw with relief that Dr. Grant was walking toward them. He had a big tear in his shirt at the shoulder, but otherwise he looked okay. Thank God, he said. I've been looking for you. Shivering, Ed Regis got to his feet and wiped the cold mud off his face and hands. He had spent a very bad half hour wedged among big boulders on the slope of a hill below the road. He knew it wasn't much of a hiding place, but he was panicked, and he wasn't thinking clearly. He had lain in this muddy, cold place, and he had tried to get hold of himself, but he kept seeing that dinosaur in his mind, a dinosaur coming toward him, toward the car. Ed Regis didn't remember exactly what had happened after that. He remembered that Lex had said something, but he hadn't stopped. He couldn't stop. He had just kept running and running. Beyond the road, he had lost his footing and tumbled down the hill and come to rest by some boulders. And it had seemed to him that he could crawl in among the boulders and hide. There was enough room. So that was what he had done. Gasping and terrified, thinking of nothing except to get away from the Tyrannosaur. And finally, when he was wedged in there like a rat between the boulders, he had calmed down a little. And he had been overcome with horror and shame because he'd abandoned those kids. He had just run away. He had just saved himself. He knew he should go back up to the road. He should try to rescue them because he had always imagined himself as brave and cool under pressure. But whenever he tried to get control of himself to make himself go back up there, somehow he just couldn't. He started to feel panicky. And he had trouble breathing, and he didn't move. He told himself it was hopeless, anyway. If the kids were still up there on the road, they could never survive. And certainly there was nothing Ed Regis could do for them, and he might as well stay where he was. No one was going to know what had happened except him, and there was nothing he could do. Nothing he could have done. And so Regis had remained among the boulders for half an hour, fighting off panic, carefully not thinking about whether the kids had died, or about what Hammond would have to say when he found out. What finally made him move was the peculiar sensation he noticed in his mouth,
The side of his mouth felt funny, kind of numb and tingling, and he wondered if he had hurt it during the fall. Regis touched his face and felt swollen flesh on the side of his mouth. It was funny, but it didn't hurt at all. Then he realized the swollen flesh was a leech, growing fat as it sucked his lips. It was practically in his mouth. Shivering with nausea, Regis pulled the leech away, feeling a tear from the flesh of his lips, feeling the gush of warm blood in his mouth. He spat and flung it with disgust into the forest. He saw another leech on his forearm and pulled it off, leaving a dark, bloody streak behind. Jesus, he was probably covered with them. That fall down the hillside, these jungle hills were full of leeches. So were the dark, rocky crevices. What did the workmen say? The leeches crawled up your underwear. They liked dark, warm places. They liked to crawl right up your... Hello! He stopped. It was a voice carried by the wind.
Hello! Dr. Grant!
Jesus, that was the little girl. Ed Regis listened to the tone of her voice. She didn't sound frightened or in pain. She was just calling in her insistent way. And it slowly dawned on him that something else must have happened, that the Tyrannosaur must have gone away, or at least hadn't attacked, and that the other people might still be alive. Grant and Malcolm, everybody might be alive. And the realization made him pull himself together in an instant, the way you got sober in an instant when the cops pulled you over. And he felt better, because now he knew what he had to do. And as he crawled out from the boulders, he was already formulating the next step, already figuring out what he would say, how to handle things from this point. Regis wiped the cold mud off his face and hands, the evidence that he had been hiding. He wasn't embarrassed that he had been hiding, but now he had to take charge. He scrambled back up toward the road, but when he emerged from the foliage, he had a moment of disorientation. He didn't see the cars at all. He was somehow at the bottom of the hill. The Land Cruisers must be at the top. He started walking up the hill, back toward the Land Cruisers. It was very quiet. His feet splashed in the muddy puddles. He couldn't hear the little girl anymore. Why had she stopped calling? As he walked, he began to think that maybe something had happened to her. In that case, he shouldn't walk back there. Maybe the Tyrannosaur was still hanging around. Here he was, already at the bottom of the hill, that much closer to home. And it was so quiet. Spooky, it was so quiet. Ed Regis turned around and started walking back toward the camp. Alan Grant ran his hands over her limbs, squeezing the arms and legs briefly. She didn't seem to have any pain. It was amazing. Aside from a cut on her head, she was fine.
I told you I was, she said.
Well, I had to check. The boy was not quite so fortunate. Tim's nose was swollen and painful. Grant suspected it was broken. His right shoulder was badly bruised and swollen, but his leg seemed to be all right. Both kids could walk, that was the important thing. Grant himself was all right, except for a claw abrasion down his right chest where the Tyrannosaur had kicked him. It burned with every breath, but it didn't seem to be serious, and it didn't limit his movement. He wondered if he had been knocked unconscious, because he had only dim recollections of events immediately preceding the moment he had sat up, groaning, in the woods, 10 yards from the Land Cruiser. At first his chest had been bleeding, so he had stuck leaves on the wound, and after a while it clotted. Then he had started walking around, looking for Malcolm and the kids. Grant couldn't believe he was still alive, and as scattered images began to come back to him, he tried to make sense of them. The Tyrannosaur should have killed them all, easily. Why hadn't it?
I'm hungry,
Lex said. Me too, Grant said. We've got to get ourselves back to civilization, and we've got to tell them about the ship.
We're the only ones who know, Tim said.
Yes, we've got to get back and tell them.
Then let's walk down the road toward the hotel, Tim said, pointing down the hill. That way we'll meet them when they come for us.
Grant considered that, and he kept thinking about one thing, the dark shape that had crossed between the Land Cruisers even before the attack started. What animal had that been? He could think of only one possibility, the little Tyrannosaur. I don't think so, Tim. The road has high fences on both sides, Grant said. If one of the Tyrannosaurs is further down on the road, we'll be trapped. Then should we wait here? Tim said.
Yes, Grant said. Let's just wait here until someone comes.
I'm hungry,
Lex said. I hope it won't be very long, Grant said.
I don't want to stay here,
Lex said. Then, from the bottom of the hill, they heard the sound of a man coughing.
Stay here, Grant said. He ran forward to look down the hill. Stay here, Tim said, and he ran forward after him. Lex followed her brother.
Don't leave me! Don't leave me here, you guys!
Grant clapped his hand over her mouth. She struggled to protest. He shook his head and pointed over the hill for her to look.
At the bottom of the hill, Grant saw Ed Regis standing rigid, unmoving. The forest around them had become deadly silent. The steady background drone of cicadas and frogs had ceased abruptly. There was only the faint rustle of leaves and the whine of the wind. Lex started to speak, but Grant pulled her against the trunk of the nearest tree, ducking down among the heavy, gnarled roots at the base. Tim came in right after them. Grant put his hands to his lips, signaling them to be quiet, and then he slowly looked around the tree. The road below was dark, and as the branches of the big trees moved in the wind, the moonlight filtering through made a dappled shifting pattern. Ed Regis was gone. It took Grant a moment to locate him. The publicist was pressed up against the trunk of a big tree, hugging it. Regis wasn't moving at all. The forest remained silent. Lex tugged impatiently at Grant's shirt. She wanted to know what was happening. Then, from somewhere very near, they heard a soft, snorting exhalation, hardly louder than the wind. Lex heard it, too, because she stopped struggling. The sound floated toward them again, soft as a sigh. Grant thought it was almost like the breathing of a horse. Grant looked at Regis and saw the moving shadows cast by the moonlight on the trunk of the tree. And then Grant realized there was another shadow, superimposed on the others, but not moving. A strong, curved neck and a square head. The exhalation came again. Tim leaned forward cautiously to look. Lex did too. They heard a crack as a branch broke, and into the path stepped a tyrannosaur. It was the juvenile, about 8 feet tall, and it moved with the clumsy gait of a young animal, almost like a puppy. The juvenile tyrannosaur shuffled down the path, stopping with every step to sniff the air before moving on. It passed the tree where Regis was hiding and gave no indication that it had seen him. Grant saw Regis's body relax slightly. Regis turned his head, trying to watch the tyrannosaur on the far side of the tree. The tyrannosaur was now out of view, down the road. Regis started to relax, releasing his grip on the tree. But the jungle remained silent. Regis remained close to the tree trunk for another half minute. Then the sounds of the forest returned, the first tentative croak of a tree frog, the buzz of one cicada, and then the full chorus. Regis stepped away from the tree, shaking his shoulders, releasing the tension. He walked into the middle of the road, looking in the direction of the departed tyrannosaur. The attack came from the left. The juvenile roared as it swung its head forward, knocking Regis flat to the ground. He yelled and scrambled to his feet, but the tyrannosaur pounced, and it must have pinned him with its hind leg because suddenly Regis wasn't moving. He was sitting up in the path, shouting at the dinosaur and waving his hands at it as if he could scare it off. The young dinosaur seemed perplexed by the sounds and movement coming from its tiny prey. The juvenile bent its head over, sniffing curiously, and Regis pounded on the snout with his fists. Get away! Back off! Go on, back off! Regis was shouting at the top of his lungs, and the dinosaur backed away, allowing Regis to get to his feet. Regis was shouting, Yeah! You heard me! Back off! Get away! As he moved away from the dinosaur. The juvenile continued to stare curiously at the odd, noisy little animal before it, but when Regis had gone a few paces, it lunged and knocked him down again. It's playing with him, Grant thought.
Hey!
Regis shouted as he fell. But the juvenile did not pursue him, allowing him to get to his feet. He jumped to his feet and continued backing away. You stupid! Back! Back! You heard me! Back! He shouted like a lion tamer. The juvenile roared, but it did not attack, and Regis now edged toward the trees and high foliage to the right.
In another few steps, he would be in hiding. Back, you! Back! Regis shouted. And then, at the last moment, the juvenile pounced and knocked Regis flat on his back.
Cut that out!
Regis yelled. And the juvenile ducked his head, and Regis began to scream. No words, just a high-pitched scream. The scream cut off abruptly. And when the juvenile lifted his head, Grant saw ragged flesh in his jaws.
Oh, no,
Lex said softly. Beside her, Tim had turned away, suddenly nauseated. His night vision goggles slipped from his forehead and landed on the ground with a metallic clink. The juvenile's head snapped up, and it looked toward the top of the hill. Tim picked up his goggles as Grant grabbed both the children's hands and began to run.
Control. In the night, the compies scurried along the side of the road. Harding's jeep followed a short distance behind. Ellie pointed farther up the road.
Is that a light?
Could be, Harding said. Looks almost like headlights. The radio suddenly hummed and crackled. They heard John Arnold say, "You there?" "Ah, there he is," Harding said, finally. He pressed the button. "Yes, John, we're here. We're near the river, following the compies. It's quite interesting." More crackling. Then, "Eat your cart!"
"What did he say?" Gennaro said. "Something about a car," Ellie said.
At Grant's dig in Montana, Ellie was the one who operated the radiophone. After years of experience, she'd become skilled at picking up garbled transmissions.
"I think he said he needs your car."
Harding pressed the button. "John, are you there? We can't read you very well. John?" There was a flash of lightning, followed by a long sizzle of radio static, then Arnold's tense voice. "Where are... who?" "We're 1 mile north of the Hipsy paddock, near the river, following some compies." "No! Damn well! Get back here! Ow!"
"Sounds like he's got a problem," Ellie said, frowning. There was no mistaking the tension in the voice. "Maybe we should go back."
Harding shrugged. "John's frequently got a problem. You know how engineers are. They want everything to go by the book." He pressed the button on the radio. "John, say again, please." More crackling. More static. The loud crash of lightning. Then, "Muldoon, need your car. Ow!"
Gennaro frowned. "Is he saying Muldoon needs our car?"
"That's what it sounded like," Ellie said. "Well, that doesn't make any sense," Harding said. "Other stuck. Muldoon wants car."
"I get it," Ellie said. "The other cars are stuck on the road in the storm, and Muldoon wants to go get them."
Harding shrugged. "Why doesn't Muldoon take the other car?" He pushed the radio button. "John, tell Muldoon to take the other car. It's in the garage." The radio crackled. "Not listen, crazy bastards! Car!" Harding pressed the radio button. "I said it's in the garage, John. The car is in the garage." More static. "Edry has... sing... one." "I'm afraid this isn't getting us anywhere," Harding said. "All right, John, we're coming in now." He turned the radio off and turned the car around. "I just wish I understood what the urgency is." Harding put the jeep in gear, and they rumbled down the road in the darkness. It was another 10 minutes before they saw the welcoming lights of the safari lodge, and as Harding pulled to a stop in front of the visitor center, they saw Muldoon coming toward them. He was shouting and waving his arms.
"God damn it, Arnold, you son of a bitch! God damn it, get this park back on track! Now! Get my grandkids back here, now!"
John Hammond stood in the control room screaming and stamping his little feet. He'd been carrying on this way for the last 2 minutes, while Henry Wu stood in the corner looking stunned.
"Well, Mr. Hammond," Arnold said, "Muldoon's on his way out right now to do exactly that."
Arnold turned away and lit another cigarette. Hammond was like every other management guy Arnold had ever seen. Whether it was Disney or the Navy, management guys always behaved the same. They never understood the technical issues, and they thought that screaming was the way to make things happen. And maybe it was, if you were shouting at your secretaries to get you a limousine. But screaming didn't make any difference at all to the problems that Arnold now faced.
The computer didn't care if it was screamed at. The power network didn't care if it was screamed at. Technical systems were completely indifferent to all this explosive human emotion. If anything, screaming was counterproductive because Arnold now faced the virtual certainty that Nedry wasn't coming back, which meant that Arnold himself had to go into the computer code and try to figure out what had gone wrong. It was going to be a painstaking job. He'd need to be calm and careful. "Why don't you go downstairs to the cafeteria," Arnold said, "and get a cup of coffee. We'll call you when we have more news."
"I don't want a Malcolm effect here," Hammond said.
"Don't worry about a Malcolm effect," Arnold said. "Will you let me go to work?"
"God damn you,"
Hammond said. "I'll call you, sir, when I have news from Muldoon," Arnold said. He pushed buttons on his console and saw the familiar control screens change. Stroke Jurassic Park main module stroke. Stroke call libs. Include biostat.sys. Include sysrom.vst. Include net.sys. Include power.module. Stroke initialize. Arnold was no longer operating the computer. He had now gone behind the scenes to look at the code, the line-by-line instructions that told the computer how to behave. Arnold was unhappily aware that the complete Jurassic Park program contained more than 500,000 lines of code, most of it undocumented, without explanation. Wu came forward.
"What are you doing, John?"
"Checking the code."
"By inspection? That'll take forever."
"Tell me," Arnold said. "Tell me."
The road.
Muldoon took the curve very fast, the jeep sliding on the mud. Sitting beside him, Gennaro clenched his fists. They were racing along the cliff road, high above the river, now hidden below them in darkness. Muldoon accelerated forward. His face was tense.
"How much farther?" Gennaro said.
2, maybe 3 miles.
Ellie and Harding were back at the visitor center. Gennaro had offered to accompany Muldoon. The car swerved.
"It's been an hour," Muldoon said, "an hour, with no word from the other cars."
"But they have radios," Gennaro said.
"We haven't been able to raise them," Muldoon said.
Gennaro frowned.
"If I was sitting in a car for an hour in the rain, I'd sure try to use the radio to call for somebody."
"So would I," Muldoon said. Gennaro shook his head. "You really think something could have happened to them?"
"Chances are," Muldoon said, "that they're perfectly fine, but I'll be happier when I finally see them. Should be any minute now."
The road curved, then ran up a hill. At the base of the hill, Gennaro saw something white lying among the ferns by the side of the road. "Hold it," Gennaro said, and Muldoon braked. Gennaro jumped out and ran forward in the headlights of the jeep to see what it was. It looked like a piece of clothing, but there was... Gennaro stopped. Even from 6 feet away, he could see clearly what it was. He walked forward more slowly. Muldoon leaned out of the car and said, "What is it?"
"It's a leg," Gennaro said.
The flesh of the leg was pale blue-white, terminating in a jagged, bloody stump where the knee had been. Below the calf, he saw a white sock and a brown slip-on shoe. It was a kind of shoe Ed Regis had been wearing. By then, Muldoon was out of the car, running past him to crouch over the leg.
"Jesus!"
He lifted the leg out of the foliage, raising it into the light of the headlamps, and blood from the stump gushed down over his hand. Gennaro was still 3 feet away. He quickly bent over, put his hands on his knees, squeezed his eyes shut, and breathed deeply, trying not to be sick.
"Gennaro!"
Muldoon's voice was sharp.
"What?"
"Move! You're blocking the light!" Gennaro took a breath and moved. When he opened his eyes, he saw Muldoon peering critically at the stump.
"Torn at the joint line," Muldoon said. "Didn't bite it. Twisted and ripped it. Just ripped his leg off."
Muldoon stood up, holding the severed leg upside down, so the remaining blood dripped onto the ferns. His bloody hands smudged the white sock as he gripped the ankle. Gennaro felt sick again.
"No question what happened," Muldoon was saying. "The T-Rex got him."
Muldoon looked up the hill, then back to Gennaro.
"You all right? Can you go on?"
"Yes,"
Gennaro said. "I can go on."
Muldoon was walking back toward the jeep, carrying the leg.
"I guess we better bring this along," he said. "Doesn't seem right to leave it here.
Christ, it's going to make a mess of the car. See if there's anything in the back, will you? A tarp or newspaper? Gennaro opened the back door and rummaged around in the space behind the rear seat. He felt grateful to think about something else for a moment. The problem of how to wrap the severed leg expanded to fill his mind, crowding out all other thoughts. He found a canvas bag with a tool kit, a wheel rim, a cardboard box, and two tarps, he said. They were neatly folded plastic. Give me one, Muldoon said, still standing outside the car. Muldoon wrapped the leg and passed the now shapeless bundle to Gennaro. Holding it in his hand, Gennaro was surprised at how heavy it felt. Just put it in the back, Muldoon said. If there's a way to wedge it, you know, so it doesn't roll around. Okay, Gennaro put the bundle in the back, and Muldoon got behind the wheel. He accelerated, the wheels spinning in the mud, then digging in. The jeep rushed up the hill, and for a moment at the top, the headlights still pointed upward into the foliage, and then they swung down, and Gennaro could see the road before them. Jesus, Muldoon said. Gennaro saw a single Land Cruiser lying on its side in the center of the road. He couldn't see the second Land Cruiser at all. Where's the other car? Muldoon looked around briefly, pointed to the left. There! The second Land Cruiser was 20 feet away, crumpled at the foot of a tree. What's it doing there?
A T-Rex threw it.
Threw it? Gennaro said.
Muldoon's face was grim.
Let's get this over with, he said, climbing out of the jeep.
They hurried forward to the second Land Cruiser. Their flashlights swung back and forth in the night. As they came closer, Gennaro saw how battered the car was. He was careful to let Muldoon look inside first.
I wouldn't worry, Muldoon said. It's very unlikely we'll find anyone.
No?
No, he said.
He explained that during his years in Africa, he had visited the scenes of a half dozen animal attacks on humans in the bush. One leopard attack, the leopard had torn open a tent in the night and taken a 3-year-old child. Then one buffalo attack in Amboseli. Two lion attacks, one croc attack in the north near Meru. In every case, there was surprisingly little evidence left behind. Inexperienced people imagined horrific proofs of an animal attack, torn limbs left behind in the tent, trails of dripping blood leading away into the bush, blood-stained clothing not far from the campsite. But the truth was, there was usually nothing at all, particularly if the victim was small, an infant or a young child. The person just seemed to disappear, as if he had walked out into the bush and never come back. A predator could kill a child just by shaking it, snapping the neck. Usually there wasn't any blood. And most of the time you never found any other remains of the victims. Sometimes a button from a shirt or a sliver of rubber from a shoe, but most of the time, nothing. Predators took children, they preferred children, and they left nothing behind. Though Muldoon thought it highly unlikely that they would ever find any remains of the children. But as he looked in now, he had a surprise. I'll be damned, he said. Muldoon tried to put the scene together. The front windshield of the Land Cruiser was shattered, but there wasn't much glass nearby. He had noticed shards of glass back on the road, so the windshield must have been broken back there before the Tyrannosaur picked the car up and threw it here. But the car had taken a tremendous beating. Muldoon shone his light inside. Empty? Gennaro said tensely. Not quite, Muldoon said. His flashlight glinted off a crushed radio handset, and on the floor of the car he saw something else, something curved and black. The front doors were dented and jammed shut, but he climbed in through the back door and crawled over the seat to pick up the black object. It's a watch, he said, peering at it in the beam of his flashlight, a cheap digital watch with a molded black rubber strap. The LCD face was shattered. He thought the boy might have been wearing it, though he wasn't sure, but it was a kind of watch a kid would have. What is it, a watch? Gennaro said.
Yes, and there's a radio, but it's broken.
Is that significant?
Yes, and there's something else.
Muldoon sniffed. There was a sour odor inside the car. He shone the light around until he saw the vomit dripping off the side door panel. He touched it, still fresh.
One of the kids may still be alive, Muldoon said.
Gennaro squinted at him. What makes you think so?
The watch, Muldoon said. The watch proves it. He handed the watch to Gennaro, who held it in the glow of the flashlight and turned it over in his hands. Crystal is cracked, Gennaro said.
That's right, Muldoon said. And the band is uninjured.
Which means?
The kid took it off.
That could have happened any time, Gennaro said. Any time before the attack.
No, Muldoon said. Those LCD crystals are tough. It takes a powerful blow to break them. The watch face was shattered during the attack.
So the kid took his watch off.
Think about it, Muldoon said. If you were being attacked by a Tyrannosaur, would you stop to take your watch off?
Maybe it was torn off.
It's almost impossible to tear a watch off somebody's wrist without tearing the hand off, too. Anyway, the band is intact. No, Muldoon said. The kid took it off himself. He looked at his watch, saw it was broken, and took it off. He had the time to do that.
When?
It could only have been after the attack, Muldoon said. The kid must have been in this car after the attack, and the radio was broken, so he left it behind, too. He's a bright kid, and he knew they weren't useful.
If he's so bright, Gennaro said, where'd he go? Because I'd stay right here and wait to be picked up.
Yes, Muldoon said, but perhaps he couldn't stay here. Maybe the Tyrannosaur came back, or some other animal. Anyway, something made him leave.
Then where'd he go? Gennaro said.
Let's see if we can determine that, Muldoon said, and he strode off toward the main road.
Gennaro watched Muldoon peering at the ground with his flashlight. His face was just inches from the mud, intent on his search. Muldoon really believed he was on to something, that at least one of the kids was still alive. Gennaro remained unimpressed. The shock of finding the severed leg had left him with a grim determination to close the park and destroy it. No matter what Muldoon said, Gennaro suspected him of unwarranted enthusiasm and hopefulness and...
You notice these prints? Muldoon asked, still looking at the ground.
What prints? Gennaro said.
These footprints, see them? Coming toward us from up the road? And they're adult-sized prints, some kind of rubber-soled shoe. Notice the distinctive tread pattern.
Gennaro saw only mud, puddles catching the light from the flashlights.
You can see, Muldoon continued, the adult prints come to here, where they're joined by other prints, small and medium-sized, moving around in circles, overlapping, almost as if they're standing together talking. But now here they are, and they seem to be running, he pointed off. There, into the park.
Gennaro shook his head. You can see whatever you want in this mud. Muldoon got to his feet and stepped back. He looked down at the ground and sighed.
Say what you like. I'll wager one of the kids survived, and maybe both. Perhaps even an adult as well, if these big prints belong to someone other than Regis. We've got to search the park.
Tonight?
Gennaro said. But Muldoon wasn't listening. He had walked away toward an embankment of soft earth near a drain pipe for rain. He crouched again.
What was that little girl wearing?
Christ, Gennaro said, I don't know.
Proceeding slowly, Muldoon moved farther toward the side of the road, and then they heard a wheezing sound. It was definitely an animal sound.
Listen, Gennaro said, feeling panic, I think we better...
Shh, Muldoon said. He paused, listening.
It's just the wind, Gennaro said.
They heard the wheezing again, distinctly this time. It wasn't the wind. It was coming from the foliage directly ahead of him, by the side of the road. It didn't sound like an animal, but Muldoon moved forward cautiously. He waggled his light and shouted, but the wheezing did not change character. Muldoon pushed aside the fronds of a palm.
What is it? Gennaro said.
It's Malcolm, Muldoon said.
Ian Malcolm lay on his back, his skin gray-white, mouth slackly open. His breath came in wheezing gasps. Muldoon handed the flashlight to Gennaro and then bent to examine the body.
I can't find the injury, he said. Head okay, chest, arms.
Then Gennaro shone the light on the legs.
He put a tourniquet on.
Malcolm's belt was twisted tight over the right thigh. Gennaro moved the light down the leg. The right ankle was bent outward at an awkward angle from the leg, the trousers flattened, soaked in blood. Muldoon touched the ankle gently, and Malcolm groaned. Muldoon stepped back and tried to decide what to do next.
Malcolm might have other injuries. His back might be broken. It might kill him to move him. But if they left him here, he would die of shock. It was only because he had had the presence of mind to put a tourniquet on that he hadn't already bled to death. And probably he was doomed. They might as well move him. Gennaro helped Muldoon pick the man up, hoisting him awkwardly over their shoulders. Malcolm moaned and breathed in ragged gasps.
Lex, he said. Lex went. Lex.
Who's Lex? Muldoon said. The little girl, Gennaro said. They carried Malcolm back to the jeep and rested him into the back seat. Gennaro tightened the tourniquet around his leg. Malcolm groaned again. Muldoon slid the trouser cuff up and saw the pulpy flesh beneath, the dull white splinters of protruding bone.
We've got to get him back, Muldoon said.
You going to leave here without the kids? Gennaro said.
If they went into the park, it's 20 square miles, Muldoon said, shaking his head. The only way we can find anything out there is with the motion sensors. If the kids are alive and moving around, the motion sensors will pick them up, and we can go right to them and bring them back. But if we don't take Dr. Malcolm back right now, he'll die.
Then we have to go back, Gennaro said.
Yes, I think so.
They climbed into the car. Gennaro said, are you going to tell Hammond the kids are missing?
No, Muldoon said.
You are.
Control. Donald Gennaro stared at Hammond, sitting in the deserted cafeteria. The man was spooning ice cream, calmly eating it.
So, Muldoon believes the children are somewhere in the park.
He thinks so, yes.
Then I'm sure we'll find them.
I hope so, Gennaro said.
He watched the old man deliberately eating, and he felt a chill.
Oh, I am sure we'll find them. After all, I keep telling everyone this park is made for kids.
Gennaro said, just so you understand that they're missing, sir.
Missing? He snapped. Of course I know they're missing. I'm not senile.
He sighed and changed tone again.
Look, Donald, Hammond said, let's not get carried away. We've had a little breakdown from the storm or whatever, and as a result we've suffered a regrettable, unfortunate accident. And that's all that's happened. We're dealing with it. Arnold will get the computers cleaned up. Muldoon will pick up the kids. And I have no doubt he'll be back with them by the time we finish this ice cream. So let's just wait and see what develops, shall we?
Whatever you say, sir, Gennaro said.
Why? Henry Wu said, looking at the console screen.
Because I think Nedry did something to the code, Arnold said. That's why I'm checking it.
All right, Wu said, but have you tried your options?
Like what? Arnold said.
I don't know. Aren't the safety systems still running? Wu said. Key checks, all that?
Jesus, Arnold said, snapping his fingers. They must be. Safety systems can't be turned off except at the main panel.
Well, Wu said, if key checks is active, you can trace what he did.
I sure as hell can, Arnold said.
He started to press buttons. Why hadn't he thought of it before? It was so obvious. The computer system at Jurassic Park had several tiers of safety systems built into it. One of them was a key check program, which monitored all the keystrokes entered by operators with access to the system. It was originally installed as a debugging device, but it was retained for its security value. In a moment, all the keystrokes that Nedry had entered into the computer earlier in the day were listed in a window on the screen. There was a string of numbers, followed by words, part words, and numerical instructions. System Nedry. Go to command level. Nedry. 040-HXY-67 MR Goodbytes. Security. Key check off. Safety off. SL off. Security. White_rabbit.object.
That's it, Arnold said. He was screwing around here for hours, it seemed like.
Probably just killing time, Wu said, until he finally decided to get down to it. The initial list of numbers represented the ASCII keyboard codes for the keys Nedry had pushed at his console. Those numbers meant he was still within the standard user interface, like any ordinary user of the computer. So, initially, Nedry was just looking around, which you wouldn't have expected of the programmer who had designed the system.
Maybe he was trying to see if there were changes before he went in, Wu said. Maybe, Arnold said.
Arnold was now looking at the list of commands, which allowed him to follow Nedry's progression through the system line by line.
At least we can see what he did.
System was Nedry's request to leave the